Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, and if you were expecting good and crazy martinis today, well, maybe tomorrow. We've got three bad ones today, one of which is breaking news as we record this. By the time you hear it, it will probably be pretty well disseminated. But issue number one, the surprising news this morning, first reported by the Wall Street Journal, Jim, that Tea Party favorite Senator Jim DeMint, first elected in 2004, reelected against the extremely tough Democrat Alvin Green in 2010. Conservative, obviously not afraid to take on his own leadership. In fact, earlier this week, he was very critical of the most recent offer the Republicans issued to President Obama on the fiscal cliff. All of a sudden, now we get the news that he is leaving the Senate effective January to become the new head of the Heritage Foundation. And while we like the Heritage Foundation, and certainly Ed Foldner deserves a break after 30-some years, the idea of not having Jim DeMint there when we're already in the minority, and while we do have some great rising Tea Party stars there, we need as many as humanly possible. And he is great in a number of ways, not only in terms of the message, but also getting out there and actively helping Tea Party and conservative candidates. It's going to hurt.
The reaction, most people are feeling very positive and cheery about this, and it's just a couple observations. One is, this is really good news for the Heritage Foundation. They are getting, you know, a lawmaker who is extremely respected on Capitol Hill and respected in the conservative movement. If anything, you might have argued that Jim DeMint was kind of the ambassador between Washington Republicans and the Tea Party. I don't think there was anybody other than maybe Marco Rubio who had better street cred amongst the Tea Party movement than Jim DeMint. What I find a bit problematic about that, somebody had said, well, why don't you see a Jim DeMint type run for Senate Majority Leader? Why don't we ever see the conservative firebrands leading this, you know, Republicans in Congress as a whole? And the answer is because once you're a leader, you have to be a consensus builder. It's very tough to be the guy who is the purest and most uncompromising conservative and be leading the group as a whole. And some people kind of say, you know, it makes it a lot easier to kind of stand on the sidelines, so to speak, and never have to compromise and never have to actually work out and get a deal. You can always hold out and say, well, I could have, you know, things could have turned out better. I don't think this is necessarily the philosophy of Jim DeMint. I think, you know, he's probably something he's had his eye on for a while, and the opportunity was there. I don't like the idea of a Senate caucus without him. And so now this creates Governor Nikki Haley of South Carolina is going to have to appoint an interim senator who will serve for the remainder of for about 2 years, and then we'll have a special election in 2014, which I believe will serve actually for only two more years, and then it'll go back to another six-year term beginning in 2016 because DeMint was reelected in 2010. You're going to hear a lot of good names mentioned as both the potential appointees. This is fantastic news for Lindsey Graham because chances are the appointee will eliminate one potential primary contender against him in the coming cycle. And the second thing is that if you are not picked and you're a conservative who was up frustrated with the direction of the Senate, et cetera, you can either take on Lindsey Graham or maybe you can take on the other guy, whoever the appointed person is. And maybe that person will be a little bit easier to defeat because that person has, you know, presumably never won a statewide election. Now, a couple of the names that I'm hearing these days, Tim Scott, currently the only African-American Republican in Congress,
right,
is my parents' congressman down in the low country of South Carolina. They love him. Tim Scott had a very long and happy career ahead of him in the House. He may want to, you know, be interested in stepping up. Mick Mulvaney, one of the Tea Party heroes who knocked off a longtime Democrat lawmaker in the 2010 midterms, a lot of street cred there. Trey Gowdy, really come to the fore on Fast and Furious and House Judiciary Committee issues. I'm told a lot of folks after, you know, You Lie wondered if Joe Wilson had any interest in going up in the world and representing in statewide office. I am reliably told he has no interest in that whatsoever. He loves what he's doing in the House, doesn't want to run for governor or senator or anything like that someday. Worth noting, though, his son is Alan Wilson, and he is currently the state attorney general of South Carolina, elected by a wide margin in 2010. He may believe it's a little early in his career to step up and, you know, depart the office he was elected to 2 years ago. And finally, a guy who also represents down the low country in South Carolina, State Senator Tom Davis, is a guy who kind of surprised some folks, has kind of drifted in the direction of the Ron Paul folks, endorsed Ron Paul for president last cycle. down the line, tough, you know, conservative reformer, not afraid to shake things up in Colombia. Anyway, that's my setup. This kind of, you know, takes the chessboard and throws a whole bunch of pieces up in the air. We don't know where all the pieces are going to land. If Nikki Haley appoints one of these members of the House, that creates a special House election there. I mean, there's all kinds of dominoes that are still waiting to fall as a result of this. Having said that, I'm not an enormous fan of losing DeMint and the insecurity about who will replace him and how this will shake out.
I think the three House members you mentioned, all of them would be solid. I think when it comes to budget issues in particular, I think Mulvaney's probably the strongest. If you want to hold people's feet to the fire, Gowdy's your guy, and Tim Scott's solid on everything. So I would be fine with any of those, with possibly a slight preference for Mulvaney. But I'm shocked, Jim, that you didn't mention Governor Appalachian Trail. I assume this would be his big chance to get back into the limelight.
The Mark Sanford comeback. I have heard a few people mention Jenny Sanford. The former first lady of South Carolina, who everyone came out of that experience with great admiration for, and a lot of people like seeing a political wife not standing by her man and not showing up for the press conference and not telling the public, you know, think well of my husband, everything's hunky-dory. There was a little bit of woman scorned in Jenny Sanford. A lot of South Carolinians kind of admitted that. Somebody had noted that, look, 2014, you're going to have two Senate races and a governor's race in a state that is obviously always important in the presidential nomination process. Just a lot of politics coming South Carolina, the Palmetto State's way in the coming months and years.
Buckle up. Well, on to our second bad martini now. And Jim, as you well know, there's been plenty of frustration with John Boehner as speaker for just how he's handled various debates, from facing a potential government shutdown to the fiscal cliff to the debt ceiling debate from last year. A lot of people feel that he negotiates with himself and that he gives away too much in the beginning of negotiations and so forth. And that's a healthy debate within the party. But what really irked a lot of conservatives, and rightly so, I think, is the fact that four very fiscal conservative members of Congress were essentially kicked off of two critical committees, two from budget, two from financial services, for not voting in lockstep with the party. According to reports, some of this may have actually come down from the committee rising chairman, in the case of financial services, Jeb Hensarling, or the existing budget committee chairman, Paul Ryan. The cardinal sin, apparently, for Justin Amash and Tim Hulskamp was to vote against the Ryan budget. They preferred the Republican Study Committee budget, which balanced things out a little bit faster. But, Jim, last I heard, these guys took oaths to the Constitution and made commitments to their constituents. I didn't realize that obeying leadership was what they were really there supposed to do. And for Boehner to come down harder on them than he does on the president, it seems like, is not the way to endear conservatives to his leadership.
Yeah, it is frustrating and disappointing. The only point I will make, which is not even a defense of Boehner, just a call for perspective on this. Yeah, an interesting exchange yesterday with Eric Telford, a good-natured and funny and smart guy over at the Franklin Institute, who said that, you know, maybe instead of calling him Speaker Boehner, we should be calling him Speaker Stalin for the way that he's purging them. Now, my response was that was an illegal use of hyperbole, a 15-yard penalty and loss of down. He wanted to appeal it. He wanted to go to replay on that. And my response was, look, in slow motion, you can see Stalin killing 20 million to 60 million people. Boehner hasn't even equaled Ted Kennedy's total in terms of killing people. So as much as I'm frustrated with Boehner, I don't think he quite warrants the Stalin comparison yet. I suppose you could see more rhetoric like that going. This is not the time for Boehner to be picking any unnecessary fights with his caucus. I don't know if this is a new stance we're going to see from Boehner in the years to come, but it is frustrating at a time when you'd really like to see the House Republican caucus as unified as possible.
Kind of reminds me of the last eruption that at least the public knew about, and that was after the cut, cap, and balance passed, and then Boehner decided before the Senate did anything to pass a watered-down version, and then I believe even one more after that, and his advice to those who wanted him to just stick and fight over cut, cap, and balance was, get your bleeps in line. That might perhaps be a more vocal way that he's going to try and keep everybody in line in the next 2 years. So we'll see how well that flies. But
Inspiring. I'm really cheered. So.
Yeah, exactly. Martini number three now. And if you thought losing Jim DeMint was bad, or retribution for conservatives for voting their conscience was bad, We're going to end today on the likely use of chemical weapons. Syria, according to most intelligence reports, has fueled some of their rockets and missiles with sarin nerve gas and now is just awaiting orders to launch them. And apparently there's a relatively brief shelf life on once you load these weapons with this nerve gas to use them. And so that's why we got the admonition from the president earlier in the week that if you use these things, well, then we're actually really going to get involved in this thing. There's no good aspect of this. Either chemical weapons get used and a lot of innocent people die, or the United States really gets entangled into another situation where there might not even be a good guy. So whatever the situation, what's happening in Syria is going from bad to worse.
About the only way this is, you know, plays out well for us or not so terrible is even the better way of describing it is to observe, well, you know, maybe this is just a bit of saber rattling, so to speak, from a dictator who's killed, you know, the greater part of 40,000 people in Syria already. You know, we've heard from this administration a great deal of, you know, this is our red line. The circumstances will change greatly. You will be held accountable. Never any specifics. And I think that's, you know, partially because Obama doesn't want to be out there talking about his intensity and his desire to send troops into Syria. The other fear is that, you know, if Assad is reckless enough and desperate enough and vicious and cruel enough to use sarin gas on the people opposing him within his own country, what exactly are we going to do in response to it? I'm really not so sure that the country really has the stomach or the desire to really get into the military intervention and all the consequences of that. And yet, a sternly worded UN resolution ain't going to do it. So we will see what happens. I am not optimistic about any of the scenarios. There are some people saying, oh, the good news is that they loaded them up, but they haven't put them up on the planes yet. And so it appears the world pressure is holding Bashar Assad's hand. I'm not so 100% confident of that. But Syria is this disaster. You can ignore a lot of weeks, but this is one week where we may not be able to ignore it. It may be getting a whole lot worse really fast.
And I think to give the Obama administration one modicum of credit, they're trying to lobby Russia to put pressure on Syria. I don't think that's actually going to work, but at least they're looking in the right direction, because Russian compliance with the Syrians through all this has been a major factor for the reason that Assad is still in power and in position to do this sort of thing. So it probably will end up on the plate of the conscience of the Russians. I just don't know that anything the United States has to say to Putin and his lieutenants is actually going to change their mind. But we'll see. It can't hurt to push, I guess. Jim, I'd say have a great day, but at least have as good a day as possible, given the horrific news we've been talking about here.
Folks, this is a rebuilding day for all of our good martinis. Maybe tomorrow will be better.
There you go. Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. And don't forget to join us on Friday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.